You were speaking about the successful Alice Chalmers
design. Yes, David. And at that time, a chain belt company here in Milwaukee who built road pavers, this large road rebuilding equipment that you see on, used to see on the highway and still do in some cases. It was done differently then in cement and so forth instead of the asphalt, which is put on in a different way today. But at that time, they had to have this huge drum mixing concrete machine on tracks, you remember, like a tank and so on and so forth. Well, this thing was built out of a quarter-inch boilerplate welded together with corners chopped off on a 45-degree and plates gusseted in and all this sort of thing, and weld lines all over the place, and had just a terrible appearing product, no style, no look, and yet it was on the main street of town with all the people driving by it to the one side and having to view it. And it would have a little name on it, Rex Chain Belt. Uh-huh. So they asked us to please try to give this some of the tractor treatment or into the styled era of the time and make it better looking. So we took all this boilerplate off, put up a structural tubing frame around it, like a trailer was later built or something. This is early in the game.
Yes.
And closed it with, well, that would have been after 37, this might have been 39 or 40 or something like that. And then actually created this enclosure around it in 20-gauge auto body sheet metal, which we rigidized in a horizontal plane with rollings running through the sheet metal, running a bead at every 2 inches for a pattern of about 2 feet. And that gave it horizontal lines, which looked more sleek and lowered the appearance, and stiffened those panels so they wouldn't oil can or bend inward and look crooked, do the welding and so forth and so on. And painted it in maroon and sand colored tan or beige, looking like the roadway or the concrete or whatever. And this became a tremendous success because it was really an improvement. Wherever road repairs had to be, the people would look at this as a mobile billboard instead of just a cement covered thing. Now, immediately it was proven by the fact that the operator of this piece of equipment hosed it down every night to remove all the cement from it and clean it up and be ready for the next day. Right. Whereas before that, they had never bothered to even dust it off. And it was just an eyesore. So this is the kind of early industrial design situations that are come to mind quickly.
Could I take you back briefly to to the Alice Chalmers? I'm fascinated by that really startling innovation that you came up with.
Well, and because that led the tractor industry into tractor styling. There had never been any design or styling prior to that. So all of the other people had to follow.
Yes.
And the John Deeres and Henry Dreyfuss finally became involved with John Deere. And International Harvester. Raymond Loewy worked with them and so forth. So we all, but we started that within that industry, and that began a complete cycle of farm equipment
design. Even Henry Ford had to
come up with
something.
The Fordson tractor became a much better looking.
Much better looking, yes. That's marvelous.
So that was a definite first. There have been many firsts in this industry. I have some more listed here quickly that I tried to pick out for you that you can go by. In the flat iron business, the first steam iron ever developed was called the Steam-O-Matic. Now, I don't know that you're going to remember that, not being a housewife or one who has to press his own trousers, but at that time it was an aluminum cast vessel on a sole plate of aluminum with a early approach at a plastic handle to fill with water, and it took a pint or a pint and a half or whatever, and then it would heat up with a thermostatically controlled heating element with the electric connection to the wall, like a regular. Flat irons then were the ones that came off the stove, you know, heated by the stove, and then finally they added electricity to it, but it was still a pretty archaic looking thing.
Yes.
This was the first one to be streamlined and cast with polished beads on it and hammered, hammer finish to give the other part, the pit marks wouldn't show, all this sort of thing. A molded plastic handle, which was called Bakelite. You remember, we didn't refer to it as plastic at the time, but it was known as that. And this became a very exciting introduction into the appliance field. And then we worked on
tank drive. Do you remember talking to someone at Steam-O-Matic saying, asking you to do something more cosmetic for them?
They gave us their preliminary prototype, which was a very, very clumsy looking affair, just whittled out of a aluminum cast rough thing and said, what can you do to this?
I see.
And we then gave it the lines that it finally was, patterns were made and castings were made, and it was taken from that. And it became an extremely successful thing. And that was followed by the petty point iron, which they then developed, which was a new electrical invention of a flat iron with a metal shroud on it, but the shroud was not fully down to the sole plate. It was opened up on the sides. And then we designed louvered plates that went in there at quarter inch distances apart to be cooling fins and let the air circulate through it. And that had a secondary point at the rear. The large point forward to iron big sleeves and flat work and linens and all that sort of thing. Then a secondary point at a 45-degree angle at the rear, where you normally would stand it up or put it into rest. And you could turn the handle around and use it the other way and do these little shearings on sleeves and shirt sleeves and shirt waists or whatever the ladies used to wear and so forth.
Well, in effect, you brought the home laundry steam iron out of the dark ages.
And then we took over with the Hamilton Manufacturing Company at their request and designed the first clothes dryer ever produced, which was the Hamilton automatic dryer. And before that, clothes had always been dried. Here is the steam iron. There is the before and after.
Yes, I remember.
Washer, and there's the petty point iron.
Oh, yeah.
And with its double points and so forth. And then we came into the clothes dryer, which was the first and welders, you see the before and after.
Oh, yes.
Now at the exhibit you'll see much of this in before and after, so it's very
welded, vivid. The welding
the mobile welder that could be taken to the job instead of having to bring the work to them. But there is the first clothes dryer, which
what did you call it?
The Hamilton dryer.
Right.
Automatic clothes dryer. Now it was invented by an inventor who came to the Hamilton Manufacturing Company, who were manufacturing all the drafting tables, medical furniture, dental equipment, and things of this nature, a large producer up here in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. And he sold them on going into this business and producing this dryer and trying to make a market for it. Clothes had been dried out in the yard on the rope or in the basement with next to the furnace or something where the heat would run. And a few mansions had walk-in clothes dryer rooms that were heated by coils or something. And you put the clothes in there, but it took forever to do it, and you could wait till the next day and so forth. And it was in a very expensive installation.
Yeah.
But this was a $250 appliance, like a washer.
Wow.
So then this, coupled with the washer dryer, gave you the real combination for the period in handling your home laundry work.
Yeah.
I found this prototype that they were struggling with up there. There was just a square sheet metal box with a door in it, and no name, nothing. If you tried to sell it to someone, they'd think it was just in the department store at Gimbel's or Macy's or wherever. It would be just a storage cabinet or something to put pots and pans or dishes. You'd see a handle, but that's all. And I said, this can never go. All of this marvelous invention of what goes on in this revolving drum and so forth inside is lost. You've got to animate this and put the window in the door and then put this in the department store, put a light inside of it, and put calico in there and have it spinning around in front of the consumer. And they'll then be able to take this home and put their husband's shorts in there and watch them go around in the dryer and so forth. And they'll know when it's on and when it's off, and all this will make it worth $250.
So the window was your
The whole concept of this, in fact, the fluted panels and the sheet metal is typical of, you might say, styling of that period, the Art Deco or whatever, but to try to make it look its value. The whole idea was to create appliances then that looked like the job they had to do, and at the point of sale, so that they were explained and not just mysterious or have to be taken door to door and say, you do this, madam, with this, and so on, which would never get anywhere.
Right.
So now then we're into the mower business and rotary mowers. The first time the rotary mower was ever built.
The first rotary mower?
First rotary mower for the
lawn boy
of Outboard Marine, another one of Ralph Evinrude's firms that he bought at that time from an inventor down in Lamar, Missouri or someplace who wasn't getting anywhere with it. And we put styling to it, and then it took off. And from then on, the rotary mower industry is absolutely supreme. There are hardly any more real mowers at all.
No.
Real meaning the
R-E-E-L
mower.
Right.
And not R-E-A-L.
Right.
So the rotary mower is today's way of cutting grass.
Yes.
And the two-cycle gasoline engine lives on and is a Briggs & Stratton four-cycle and two-cycle.
Mm-hmm.
That's a natural...
Lawnmower is still very much...
Oh, it's the largest selling mower there is.
Mm-hmm.
There are many competitors, Snappers and you name it, Toros
right.
and all the rest of them.
Jacobson's.
And we... created what was called Lawn Boy Green, which is its trademark color.
Still today.
That has lasted to be that way ever since.
Gorgeous bright green.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is a sort of a potpourri of the period in there of getting ready for the post-war.
Period for you.
Yes, it was. For
Can you think back and imagine how it all happened?
No, because it would be from day to day, and we'd see an opportunity here, and we'd provoke interest there, and we'd send out brochures telling about one triumph after the other or something, and then that would say, well, what could you do with this?
Uh-huh.
And we brought together more people within industry into interrelating with each other
mm-hmm.
than ever had been done in the past,
mm-hmm.
and cross-pollinization would create other products and other ways of doing things. The plastics moved in. We got
right.
into the radio plastic business and the early television sets.
Your early Bakelite.
Oh, yes, Bakelite.
Yeah.
And then in the truck field, we took on a tremendous approach to the vehicle field and created really the first motor home for H.F. Johnson Jr.,
I'd like to hear
head of Johnson and Wax.
Yes,
and
created, over in Racine?
Yes, in Racine,
mm-hmm.
and the famous Fibber McGee and Molly
right.
TV shows and
Johnson
so on and so forth.
Uh-huh.
Johnson Wax. And he called me in the early period of, let's see, when did we do that? In probably... Well, I remember the first, what started all of this brief
yes.
was this tractor-trailer combination
yes, uh-huh.
for Mr. William Woods Plankton.
Yes.
And that's a 1936 development that this man was from here, Milwaukee, the Plankton Hotel, the Plankton Arcade. He was the scion of the Plankton Millions, which is a large packing company fortune,
oh, yes.
like Armour. And,
but in the Northwest.
In this part.
Mm-hmm.
And so this wealthy young man decided that he was going to land travel. And the trailer had come out of the war as the migrant worker home,
mm-hmm.
the home on wheels,
right.
trying to pull it with a Hudson sedan or whatever, mm-hmm. which raised hell with the rear end and differential and transmission. And
mm-hmm.
they'd only make a few hundred miles, and then it would tear the car apart, which was never designed by Detroit. And I mean, to be condemned because it wouldn't pull 5,000 or 6,000 pounds behind it was like saying, why isn't your Ford a truck?
Mm-hmm.
You know, your passenger car a truck
right.
that could pull ice or coal or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But here, this man decided that this was the time to go around the country as a sportsman he was and mm-hmm. visit people all over the... He'd lived in Europe for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So the cab over engine International Harvester truck was the first cab over engine mm-hmm. design truck that had been created for the marketplace, mm-hmm. meaning that there was no longer a hood out in front, but you put the engine back underneath the seat or the driver forward
mm-hmm.
and put that all over the front steering wheels and then drove that vehicle through a drive shaft to the rear end.
Mm-hmm.
But it condensed the front end from 6 or 7 feet long, including the hood and cab,
mm-hmm.
to maybe 55 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And by putting the driver and the passenger beside the engine, and it came up through the with a cover over it in the front compartment.
Right.
And that became the chassis vehicle, which I said could pull this large trailer that he envisioned, which was over 30 feet long or something like that, and was going to weigh a lot and would be a tremendous thing to have to pull.
Mm-hmm.
So we purchased the chassis and designed this aerodynamic, we said then,
yes.
and it was, in
mm-hmm.
a sense,
very
this
nice
vehicle, we could travel with that at 75 to 80 miles an hour, because I put a high-speed rear end in here.
Oh,
and incidentally, I took out, after the first several maiden voyages with this, a six-cylinder International Harvester engine and put into it your famous flathead Mercury 110 horsepower V8.
Right.
And that really pulled this thing like a train.
Mm-hmm.
And we could do probably 70 to 80 miles an hour in top gear, overdrive gear,
mm-hmm.
which had a transmission in it with an overdrive, which we pulled out of the thing like the Lincoln had.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So that was the beginning then of a long spell of this vehicle design that was unique in the country and the first motor home, because when we were in Racine, we worked for the Weary Luggage Company. Weary, W-H-E-A-R-Y, Weary Luggage. Mm-hmm. Back 20 or 30 years ago, they made all the most famous suitcases and trunks and luggage in the world. George Weary is a 75 or 6 years old now, and long retired, sold the business to the other competitor. I've forgotten what their name was.
Tourister?
No, before Tourister.
Oh, before Tourister.
There were two big names,
yes,
and he just sold it out to them. But we were visiting down there. One of my staff at that time was James Rowan, whose father was the inventor of the day-old chick business. Do you remember the period of the day-old chick, where they mass raised these things to be day-old and sold them out and so on and so forth? Well, he was, and had a big mansion on Main Street in Racine.
Uh-huh.
And we had, Alice and I had been loaned the trailer, tractor and trailer of Bill Plankton, with its chauffeur driver and a Japanese butler, which rode up in the front. And incidentally, that tow car was able to be a home on wheels for two people. So in a sense, I was already, you might say, putting forth the formula for a motor home, but we didn't know what to call it or whatever. But when he was out in the tundra somewhere, he could detach the tractor from the trailer and drive this thing out fishing with the chauffeur, and they could sleep in the rear end of it. It had two berths in there, a refrigerator, running water, an outboard motor in the luggage compartment, and endless other accoutrements, and was a very viable motor home. So while we were standing there on the front of this man's house, who was one of my employees at the time, his family home, Hib Johnson drove by and saw this, and he called his executives from the company, and the Whitman Publishing Company also saw it. Western Printing and Lithographing Company, or Whitman Publishing, largest producer of all children's books, games, and things of that, storybooks and Bo Peep and all this sort of thing, which is now all done on audio visual or something, but was a tremendous thing for our youth of America then.
Yes.
And they saw this vehicle, and collectively I was approached the next week by both the Johnson Wax Company and Western Printing. And we created a line of sales cars for Western Printing, which were merely taking the front of the tractor of Plankton, the rear of his trailer, bringing that forward and making a vehicle only 20 feet long, or 19.6, on a wheelbase that was comfortable to park and so forth. And this fellow, the salesman, went out with that instead of the Hudson coach with a trailer behind it to sell these books. And inside of this was a roomy, comfortable sales room with the drawers and the counters to show the merchandise and so forth. And instead of going to the store and coming from the hotel downtown, where he had shipped his trunks full of all this books and printed games and whatnot, and hoping for a arrangement with a customer, he'd go to the store, try to drag this fellow out of the Gimbel's buying department, who was on the phone and yelling at people and so forth, and didn't want to leave, didn't want to buy anything anyhow, and drag him hopefully to the hotel to look at his line, and he just wouldn't get out there, he wouldn't go there. So it was a terrible siege, and he'd have to bring it over piecemeal and then sell only a little of the line. So we took the line to the store, parked this thing on the street down below. He'd go up to the same guy's office and say, George, I'm here again, but now wait, it's not the Plankton Hotel this time. It's look out the window. He'd go and look out the window, here are the people standing around this thing, clamoring to get on. The only problem we had with these at first was every time it came to a stop in the downtown Cleveland or someplace, a little old lady knocked and wanted to get on, thinking it was a bus. And we had that.
Was this that actually the first of,
oh,
of that
there had been
genre?
Oh, there had been attempts at taking a big truck and putting a box on it, and, but they were cumbersome things, but not a sales car. Not, we could run 85, 90 miles an hour on the highway. It had aerodynamic contours that were good. It had good mileage. We used the Mercury flathead in there and ran. We built 6 and 8 of these a year for 5 years thereafter until they had a tremendous fleet. And it began this way of merchandising and this way of selling, and put Mobile sales cars on the road. And in turn, when Hib Johnson saw this, he said to himself, now he was in the throes of losing the Asian sources of raw wax from China and whatever, where there was a Chino-Russo war or whatever, some terrible mess over there in that period of the 37 or 8. And he was having to bring his Coronaba wax from Brazil and bring it up here, the Coronaba palm leaf, and extract the wax from that in order to continue in business. So he said, build me this land cruiser, we called it, and I'll be able to live in it as an office and a sleeping headquarters and food and whatnot with a driver and a mechanic, and we can go into the tundra of Brazil and sort out these sources and get all this done, and I have a place to go and not a hotel and 5,500 miles away or something like that. So that was the first motor home, and after that we built a number of those, the large streamlined units. So all of that is in that early vehicle period.
That's incredible.
And then after the post-war, machine tools stemming from the household tools into Kearney and Trechter milling machines, big lathes and Falk Corporation gear grinders and gear cutters and endless things in that direction. And
how big of a staff did you have in Dallas?
Well, by then probably up to 15 or so. And I never operated with anything larger than 20. At this time in 44 was when the Society of Industrial Designers was created.
Yes.
By the greats in New York, so to speak.
By the who?
The greats.
Yes.
The Lowy, Dreyfus, right. Teague, and Walter Darwin Teague, and so forth. And at that time, I received word that I was chosen as one of the 10 fellows of this, and the only one in the Midwest. One other man from Los Angeles, Joseph Sinnell. I don't know whether you remember the name, because he was an older man at the time and long gone before.
Remember his fellow's name?
Sinnell, S-I-N-E-L. Sinnell, Joseph Sinnell. And he was not a prominent in the area out there, it was, but it was so embryonic then that there were only 10 of us, you might say, that of any real consequence in the profession at that time, which now 10,000 or whatever.
So you were one of the original 10 fellows,
fellows of
the Society of Industrial Design.
Yes. In 44.
44, yes.
This was July 44.
Who was the spark plug behind the formation?
Walter Darwin Teague.
Was he?
Who was the granddaddy of the whole profession.
Yeah.
And the one, Lowy and Van Doren, or Lowy and Teague were into a lawsuit thing about, with the government at that time, trying to prove that they were professionals. And they did prove for the profession that this was a profession and not just a art business or something.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they had tax situations that were being studied and so forth, and they won the suit against the government. And that's how they even got to know one another, was in both of them pursuing this, because in those days these fellows walked down the street and went on the other side of the street from one another, because they were, he's a competitor, you know, and so on. And I remember being invited to New York in July of 44, July 11th to be exact, and we met at the penthouse of Henry Dreyfus on top of some building there in Manhattan, and all of us were together for the first time, and it was a very strange sort of a feeling, but interesting.
Can I remember some of the
George Sakier and Sakier, S-A-K-I-E-R, and I'll never forget him, because he sidled up to me with a Manhattan in one hand or something and said, oh, you're Brooke Stevens from out in the Midwest, from Milwaukee, is it? Sauerkraut Bay? And that was his reference to Milwaukee. Beer and sauerkraut.
Was Mr. Balgettys there, or Norman Balgettys?
Yes, Norman Balgettys. Now, he was the great experimenter and always drawing the pictures of a multi-engined airplane that might cross the ocean someday.
Right.
He didn't know how to do it, but he drew a rendering of it, and of course such a thing did come about. Whether it was sponsored by that or not, I'm not sure. But it was a great interest.
It must have been, yes.
And then I went to all the meetings thereafter. And then we began to build a membership, and finally it changed to ASID, which it is now, and it's maybe got 10,000 or what. I'm not active anymore. But
that was incredible.
That tells the story of that. But throughout all of this, a great deal of then in the marine industry, we branched into motorboat design.
Yes.
You'd say, you mean Chris Craft? Well, yes, we worked for Chris Craft.
Did you?
We did their large 42-foot.
Was Garwood still in the
Yes,
business?
They were in the business.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here was the railroad train. And this diners and... The first use of melamine laminates, which was the fancy name for plastic. Of the Formica. And I was retained by the Formica company to develop patterns for them, colors and patterns of, you know, modular things.
Right.
Like we created the first photographs of marble and made into plastics for the restaurant table and linen. Do you remember the linen finish for tables?
Oh, yes, of course.
That was a formica potential.
Mm-hmm.
And I put every panel in this train in 1944, 5, and 6 into formica panelings, real wood panels where we photographed the wood grain,
mm-hmm.
buried it inside this melamine laminate so that when they stuck the cigarettes against the wall going down the aisle out to the door, it didn't ruin it.
Mm-hmm.
Up to that time, it had all been varnished wood, actual lumber, varnished.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they just kept putting varnish on over varnish, over varnish until it was that thick.
Yes.
And then cigarette butts on the windowsills and seats were burned. I tell you, we never realized what human beings did to public transportation until we got into the river.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the average person buying a ticket on a bus or a train or a ship felt that this was a license to just degrade the
place,
do whatever it was.
Yes.
The ladies' rooms, you wouldn't believe it, were just mm-hmm. lipstick written all over. I mean, just mm-hmm. a terrible mess. And I mean, the maintenance on a train was that was the greatest problem at the end of the line, was to get the thing ready to go again.
Yes. So the formica
did all of that, took care of all of that,
yes.
Right down to the wall finishes, the ceilings,
mm-hmm.
the roofs, the panels, and looking like the real wood because we photographed the wood,
mm-hmm.
so it had to look just like it.
You used an applique over the...
It was a substrate,
and
formica on both sides so
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't warp.
Right.
You had to pull top and bottom either way. And we, in designing these lounge cars, we went into departing from seats lined up along the wall and
right.
seats on the other wall, and you face each other. You sit there and you wonder whether to speak or do I look, or
yeah.
there's a nice looking girl there, should I sit, and, you know.
Yes.
But this gave us the group seatings
mm.
In 7 and 4, and some looking out and some looking in.
Mm-hmm.
And the first to use greens, actually
mm-hmm.
they were also synthetic.
Mm-hmm.
The potted palm became a plastic replica,
uh-huh.
and it always looked green. You never had to water it, and so on and so forth.
Wow.
And I mean, those were all, there's the Skytop Lounge,
yes.
you know, and there's the look of it looking out
through. The first real observation.
Yes, the real, others. Now the Broadway and the 20th Century had only the curve in one plane, vertical wall
right.
at the rear end, with a couple of windows in
mm-hmm.
it. Or way before that was the real outdoor
mm-hmm.
observation,
uh-huh.
but you couldn't stand out there at 100 miles an hour.
No. Mm-hmm.
That used to be when they ran 50 and 60.
Yes.
And so there were all those innovations of that period. Would you mind if I took... In the outboard field, of course, being so heavily involved with Evinrude and
mm-hmm.
the rest of outboard marine and pioneers, we literally, you might say, gave design, exterior design or aesthetic design to the outboard motor as such
mm-hmm.
by starting as early as 1934 and enclosing the outboard, making it less noisy, less dirty, less
mm-hmm.
oily, less fumes and so on, taking the exhaust underwater and innovations like that
uh-huh.
and creating twist grip throttle controls and steering arms, and then ultimately the steering wheel with the
mm-hmm.
rope system to do it and run it from in front of the boat instead of the rear.
Easy starting devices.
Easy starting,
mm-hmm.
Compression releases and cranking, and then finally electrical starting, and then the recoil starter, which is now on every mower,
right.
and chainsaw, and you name it. Those were all the innovations of that period.
Wonderful.
So there has been a lot of pioneering. That took us into golf cars and garden tractors, and we've worked for all the major garden tractor manufacturers, Simplicity, Bohlen's, Gilson, Kutprod, Berka of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I was brought over there in the early 60s to redesign their whole tractor line and garden
really?
Equipment and mowers and snow blowers and things of that nature.
I note from this morning's tour that there was an early automobile that they...
Yes, the Kutprod Superior.
Yes.
You saw the little car
yes.
there.
Mm-hmm.
That one, Kutprod's father started that. He was in the motorcycle business and built the Kutprod motorcycle in Germany.
Uh-huh.
And then when the automobile came into being, he got into that business in the early 50s, and Walter Kutprod and his brother carried it on through 56 or so, and finally, in view of the Volkswagen, which just took the marketplace and went. All the Good Broads and Borg Wards and other names, of which there were half a dozen in Europe, just had to give up and not fight the VW. And so they've continued on, and they're the largest producer of lawn and garden equipment and tractor, garden tractors and floor polishing and floor washing and sweeping and hay reaping and all of that accessory type of business in Europe.
And did you work with their full line?
Oh yes, we went through everything. Started in 19, probably 60, early 60. Well, now we'll continue on with just a cross-section of other situations, and I'm going to have to just bring these up by name. They won't mean too much to others, and these are local firms, but the Universal Duplicating Machine Company, way back we designed the first duplicating machines to make them look well within an office. They were archaic looking things. Lowy worked on one too at that time in the early days. That was one of his early developments. But there was a manufacturer here. Durant Manufacturing Company, numerical counters, Young Radiators, space heaters, Delta Manufacturing Company, electronic fence control units, Bradley Wash Fountain Company. These were wash fountains for the industry and the home and schools and commercials.
Yes.
They're still being built today.
What did you do for Delta, by the way?
All their home workshop too.
Oh, fine. Yes.
And then they moved into, they were taken over by Rockwell Industries, and we went on with the lines there for some time thereafter. And in Montgomery Ward and Sears Roebuck, we got involved with them in the early, in the late 60s and toward the 70s, up to through 75 and 8, in the bicycle business. And did all the, having started with Cleveland Welding Company in Cleveland way back, and introduced the first bicycles that tried to look like its adult prototype, or the motorcycle. And we designed the Harley-Davidson big twins here, the motorcycles, and created the tanks and the instrument panels and the fender shapes, changing them from just mud guards to fenders with a front and a back and torpedo look or whatever, and the instrument panels with speedometers built in instead of being a separate instrument. And you know what that's become. I mean, the Japanese have gone absolutely to the nth degree with this, with the motorcycle.
They've taken your concept and run away.
And the E.R. Wagner Manufacturing Company here in Milwaukee at the time was the largest producer next to Bissell of carpet sweepers, and that went on for many, many, many years, right up to the tank-type cleaners, electric and suction-type things. Washing machines, we've been through I don't know how many firms in the washing machine business, and refrigerators.
Do you remember your earliest contact with the washing machine industry?
It was Barton here.
Barton?
Barton Washers. And then went on with Speed Queen, which is a well-known name up here in the state. And then I must regress a little to 1939 again for the New York World's Fair.
Please do.
39, at which I went to the fair with Mr. Johnson and his driver and mechanic. We took the train out to Oneonta, New York, where we built the land yacht or land cruiser, and drove it from there to the New York World's Fair, and went, put it into the Brazilian pavilion because of their connection with the Brazilian wax sources.
Right.
And this thing, we were on the very first television broadcast ever made from the 39 World's Fair.
Really?
And there are pictures of Hib Johnson, who's long since gone now. His son is running the business now. Young Sammy Johnson. He's young, he's 60 some years old. And I can remember taking him on the train down to this place in New York when I was just a little fella. So that was the first television broadcast, and we were able to see this on a monitor in a tent that we went into, and they played this thing back for us at the time. And the equipment was enormous, you know, huge cameras and weird props and lights and tin reflectors to deflect the. And about that time, I became the corporate designer for the Miller Brewing Company. And Frederick Miller, who was Kip's godfather and a close friend of ours, who was killed tragically in his own private plane, which we had designed back in 57 or 8. But I began with them and developed the select bottle with the clear and the cross-neck label and the soft cross, which is the Miller logo, which mm-hmm. you see today, Miller High Life.
Uh-huh.
And even though the brewery was sold in 75, we went from 40-something up till then consistently and did all the administration building, redesigned the old bottle houses and brew houses, made Sterneberts out of a castle building that used to be part of their mm-hmm. office way back in the 1890s or something like that, with a Sternevert and all the bars and German fixtures and so forth. I was, after Fred Miller's death, I was sent to Germany by the new president, Norman Klug, mm-hmm. who for some reason didn't want to go to Europe. He was reluctant to go.
Mm-hmm.
I was sent to the original castle in Sigmaringen, Germany, which was the homestead of the Hohenzollerns,
mm.
the Baron, Count Hohenzollern or Baron or whatever they
Prince
were called in Germany. Prince, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He was the crown prince, that's
mm-hmm.
right, Hohenzollern. And the family had been there. The castle went back to 1066 or something with 1,004 rooms or something, and incredible thing in the mountains in Sigmaringen, Germany,
mm-hmm.
where Frederick Miller the First was the official brewmaster for the prince, the
mm-hmm.
crown prince, and had his own little brewery within the castle
mm-hmm.
and produced a beer, which he then decided, because of religious prosecution, to come to and to get out of Germany, leave
mm-hmm.
and go to England, and then come over here,
mm-hmm.
and came to Wisconsin by carriage from New York State. Drove all through the country trying to find the proper place, the proper water and whatnot, and came into Wisconsin and found that the water was right, and built the brewery down in the Plank Road Brewery down in the valley here, west of us,
mm-hmm.
and started the brewery, which then became the famous Miller Brewing Company,
mm-hmm.
now absorbed by the big cigarette company.
Philip Morris.
Can you tell us a bit about the inspiration behind that famous Miller logo and
yes.
label?
The cross, the soft cross, which we call the logo,
mm-hmm.
was taken from the cross-neck label on the bottle.
Uh-huh.
You know, above the body label, which is on a slant,
right.
there is this cross-neck label, which was the only configuration that would fit that concave
uh-huh.
sweep of the select bottle design.
Mm-hmm.
And when you took the label off, it was flat, but when you put it on there, it would fit the compound curves by being
mm-hmm.
these 4 points. So I merely abstracted that
uh-huh.
and made it shallower and made a badge out of it.
Uh-huh.
And that became the new Miller logo.
It certainly has survived for many years.
It certainly has.
Yes.
And we've now, let's see, I'm trying to pick out other industries here so that you, well, we told you all about the Kaiser Pride, American Motors.
Well, let's at this point, reluctantly, but I think we should, pick up your automotive design career at this point. The Jeep has come out. The Jeepster is a success.
Yeah. And you want to go on from there and chronologically?
Yes. How does
pick
that
up
sound?
On that?
But,
is that our
intersperse it with your industrial design career as well?
Yeah, I'm trying to find things. The toy business, Binghamton Toy Company,
mm-hmm.
Junior Toy Corporation, Velocipedes. We created what was called the Rocket Trike, which was the first to change in a tricycle. You look at the frame there on that exercise bike and you see
yes.
that you have almost a tricycle look there.
Uh-huh.
If it had two wheels in the back, it would be a tricycle
uh-huh.
that the kids rode on.
Right.
But the tricycle had never been changed in its history from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It was taken from the big high wheelers that the men rode on in races of the 1900s
mm-hmm.
and made for children as a velocipede.
Right.
And of course they were a little bit dangerous because it being a one wheel triangle this way
mm-hmm.
intended to fall over on the 45
right.
and the kid could turn too fast and
yes.
tip over. But they were the fun vehicle for the child before he could ride the two-wheeler, the famous
mm-hmm.
one that he either
yes,
rode or fell off. And
remember.
For that we created the Rocket Trike, which took the frame away completely, put a single tube through the center, landing, you remember seeing those with the fenders
yes.
on them and so forth.
Of course.
And it had the plastic nose piece and all that that lighted up and
uh-huh.
looked like a rocket. Now imagine, this was back in the 50s somewhere, and
uh-huh.
we had no idea of the, we knew only of the German buzz bomb maybe.
Right.
But, there was prophetics about, in popular science about the
right.
going to the moon and all that.
But the V-2 and the V-1 and the
yeah,
V-2.
Yeah, but they came, but they were just projectiles to kill something,
right.
not to go someplace.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So this rocket trike, in a sense, was predicting that someday they would ride a rocket to the moon or whatever.
Had you been an enthusiast of
it? Oh, yes. It was just playing around. But
That took off. That was a
And then success. We got into the golf car end of vehicle design, and through the Cushman division of the Outboard Marine, developed golf cars, and that's where the famous one for Jackie Gleason came from.
Oh, yes, I've heard about that.
I have a
yes.
picture, but it's a Rolls-Royce golf car that had the Rolls-Royce front end on it.
Now, did you actually put a Rolls-Royce front end on it? Well, was that seen in the photographs?
You've seen the pictures of it, I guess. Mm-hmm. We took the little Rolls radiator that was made for the Volkswagen.
Oh, I see.
In fact, I built changed a Volkswagen for Alice in 75 and called it the Rolls-Wagen.
I remember.
And put the nose on it and the cane on the side of the body.
Uh-huh.
Like it. She drives it still.
Yes.
You can imagine.
Yes.
As a second car.
Uh-huh.
I guess we covered the clothes dryer and Hot Point Corporation, Johnson McWherry.
What did you do for Hot Point?
A lot of automatic washers, dryer. That was Speed Queen and so forth. Buffet servers, mobile charcoal units, cooking equipment, all kinds of ranges and internal barbecue units for the porch and the outdoors, and can be brought into the kitchen and taken out again. Amco Tools, Bucyrus Serie chain belt. Bamford Limited in Uttoxeter, England. Uh-huh. The first backhoe inventor. J.C. Bamford himself was from a family of great wealth up in Uttoxeter, England, a little up in the Shakespeare country, near where the cottage of Shakespeare or some famous, the author of
Near Avon?
Yes, Avon. Mm-hmm. And he came out of the war with $8 American in his pocket, and from the army, the English army at the time, went back home, and his family built wheelbarrows, and he was not going to have anything to do with them or live off of them or do anything. So he invented the backhoe as a means of digging a grave, which is grave and sinister and forbidding. But this had always been shoveled out on a slant, and then so on. This backhoe thing could dig straight down and dig a hole that was 6 feet or 7 feet by 4 by 6 or whatever.
It was powered.
And the backhoe was this device on the end of a tractor.
Mm-hmm.
And they became the largest producer of backhoes, excavators, and mobile crane equipment in all of Europe, and for the most part over here. A. O. Smith stationary welders and Miller Electric portable welders, body flow scanners for Metroflow, Franklin Electric submersible pump controls, heat guns, Erie Controls oxygenator, Olympic ice rink surfacers for J.I. Case Company, machine tools for Gorton, and it goes on here large situations like Gamble Scagno cooperatives up in Minneapolis, where they produce a whole line of products and buy products from the outside and sold them through the Gamble stores.
Yes,
chain or Gamble stores.
How do you spell that chain's name again?
Gamble.
No, the
Gamble
one.
Gamble Scagno.
Scagno.
S-K-O-G-M-O.
Right.
Gamble Scagno. Burt Gamble was the head of it,
and
Don and Phil Scagno. And that started way back as one of the earliest cooperatives, and where they get together and
ran
in. And Pacific Supply Corporation out in Seattle was another large cooperative that then retained us to create their new corporate identity and all the packaging that went with it.
You were doing a lot of that.
Oh, a lot of packaging, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The corporate identity work. Yeah.
Yes, and still do. I mean, it's been a tremendous amount of it. People like Edelman, Novelty Cleaners and Dyers, Atherton Engineering Company in England, which was a diamond mining device that we created the marine engineering for them, and the device to go below the ocean off of the coast of Africa and dig for diamonds. They found a field out there somewhere under the water.
Incredible.
And Bamford Brady Company, that's the tape people. Bucyrus Erie is the heavy equipment, what you'd call a motorized shovel or foundation digger and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
3M Company.
You've had a long continuing relationship with 3M
Company.
Huh?
Yes, that went on for many, many years.
What is happening there?
Well, that we worked there from 63 up till 75 or 80 maybe.
Uh-huh.
and still do work for them now.
Mm-hmm.
But we redesigned their whole line, the new corporate identity, the packaging, the and they had 36,000 products, and just there was no end to it. It went on and on. Kearney and Trecker Milling Machines, Manpower Incorporated, which is a, remember Manpower Incorporated, the creator of a business to hire out tentative workers, you know, to work secretaries for 3 days,
right,
a snow shoveler for five, or a drill press operator for 6 months, or whatever.
You created that whole concept for
it. Yes, and the logo for it, which is the circle with the, you might call it the neuter figure, just a circle and a three-pointed type mankind. Implied,
right.
Because they were beginning to do the same with women,
right.
And even though Manpower was all male at the beginning, this then symbolized at least that it was neuter, or could be either men or women. Trecker Aircraft Corporation. And now, if we do go back to the motor car thing,
what'd you do for Trecker Aircraft?
They created a new plane and built it in Genoa, in Europe, in Italy, off of Italy, Genoa,
right,
and. Brought it to the States. It was a high-wing, twin-engine, executive aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the exterior and interior of that.
Did that prosper? Have they prospered?
Well, it went on for 12 or 15 years, and then it was outmoded from the standpoint of executive jets, and new Lear came in and changed all that. So,
I see.
Kearney and Trecker, that was a separate firm of it. But in the automobile thing, I told you about the Paxton, I think. Should we go back to that?
Let's go back to your automotive career and leisurely stroll.
Out of the Willys thing came the Kaiser Frazier Corporation situation, where I'd met them during this business with the early stages of...
Now, did you have a sort of a reunion with Joe Frazier?
Oh, yes, after when he started there. And, that came to a tragic end when
Did they have a falling out?
Yes, it was between them. It was a matter of who did what. And remember, he'd brought Graham Page into the picture. And
that's
that
right,
was the
yes.
The nucleus of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And then Darren got in this thing. And
this was Dutch Darren, the
Dutch Darren,
automotive
Howard
designer.
Darren.
Mm-hmm.
And he did
Howard
the,
Darren, yeah.
Did the first. He was Dutch to everybody.
Yeah,
was
right.
And then...
he'd come out of the old custom...
Oh, yeah, all totally. Out of Paris. He was in Paris for... most of the life.
And for some years you were Tom Hibbard.
Hibbard and Darren.
Right.
They were the Caracerae.
Right.
And so we got into the Kaiser Frazier thing, and then from Kaiser Frazier Corporation, we, we probably went next to Studebaker Corporation.
Yes. Before we did Kaiser Frazier, if I may ask you, what were the specific, tell us again, the specific products that you did for Kaiser Frazier?
Well,
summary.
We began with the 46, 7, and 8, 9, Kaiser and Frazier, there were the two makes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we got up through 51, and we had done all, after Darren left there with the internal problems that they had, so on and so forth, it was our job under Edgar and Henry, as long as he was involved.
Frazier had left.
Yes, Frazier had left and gone back to, went to the, remember he went back into his old nucleus of the Graham Page thing, and out of that came this rototiller.
Oh, did he?
And he took that to the marketplace and went on with that until he died, and that was very successful.
Very
rototiller was this first thing that
you
used at the home and ground up the earth.
Small plowing.
Little
tilling,
He got somehow the inventor and the patent on that.
Smart.
And made it go.
Mm-hmm.
So
you were working with Edgar and, in some respects, Henry.
Well, Henry was just on the outskirts of things then, and he was moving out of the picture. But Edgar was the real running of that company.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did all the facelifts and rework and everything for 47, 8, 9... 51, the new front end, and we changed the Frazier, if you remember. There's one over there.
That's
the first one.
Mm-hmm.
That is the show car from New York.
Is it really?
In 1951, that was in the show, and I bought the thing out of the show and brought it back here, and we've had it ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And I drove it for years. Finally, we put a Ford V8 in it.
Good.
Did you?
A Ford 27 or whatever the big Ford was in about my son David transferred the engine because Edgar asked if I'd loan him the car back for his wife to go to Palm Beach 1 year. And he had some guy come and drive it down to Palm Beach and then bring it back a month later. Mm-hmm. And this guy just drove the tail off this car and ran all the bearings and wrecked the engine. And then just delivered it back here with it hammering and so forth and said, sorry, but something is wrong with it. We said, yes, how fast did you go all the way? So David put a Ford in it and it solved that. And we drove it some after that.
What was your relationship with the Kaisers in those days? Did you?
Very,
was it a good?
First of all, I'll tell you, the real human side of the story comes out when we're first meeting in California with Robert McCulloch and all. And Robert McCulloch was given the contract to create the first front-wheel drive small car.
I see.
And to do the prototype work.
He had been the chainsaw entrepreneur.
He was the entrepreneur of that.
Yeah.
So he got this big thing and he retained us to do the body design of this. And we brought this car all the way up to a full-size mock-up and had the engineering part of it ready to go and so on and so forth. And then they got into a terrible battle about money and they had a falling out and the project died. And that's when Robert started the Paxton car of his own manufacturer to put on the market in 46.
Did he ask you to give him a hand with that?
Oh yeah, we did the
tell us a little bit about the Paxton. I don't think anyone knows.
No, I know, no. It's been written up in the magazines but way back.
Yeah.
But the Paxton car was a rear engine car. A two-door, five-place convertible, hard top, with the first disappearing top, where we dropped the roof over the rear deck. It was the shape of the rear deck, a counterpart of it. Uh-huh. You'll see that in the exhibition.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it slid down on rails, electrically operated on cables, and you could lower the top at will, and have it, and the rear window went over the license plate so you could see it through it and so on. Yeah. And it was the first fiberglass body, except for a sports car, which we found through this fellow named Bill Tritt, T-R-I-T-T. Have you ever read about him?
I think
he was the first entrepreneur with, we call it banana skins and glue, starting up out in California, that took, he was in the business of repairing leaky boat hulls, wood planked hulls, that had you had to caulk with the caulking and the rope and the
laborious
jamming it in there and then gooing it up with the painter's glazing or whatever and then paint it and of course the next year it was all open again and whatnot. So he found this great material which was later to become called fiberglass from the resin people and the cloth part of it came from one of the major fiber manufacturers, glass cloth.
In Toledo?
Toledo, yes it was.
Mm-hmm.
And
Libby
Owens Ford. And then this resin was a chemically binding sort of thing that they mixed together. Mm-hmm. And you put these mats over it. And he was matting over the outside of open seamed wooden fishing boats and then letting it dry on there and then painting it, and then you never had to caulk that hull again. One day by mistake, David, he made one too thick. He applied, or a worker put too much on or something. It got too thick, and when he got through and turned the boat over, it fell off. And here was a mold and a hull.
Yes.
And he suddenly said, well, my God, I could strengthen that thing with ribs around gunnel and so forth and make a boat out of this instead of all this lumber business. So the glass spar sport outboard runabouts and rowboats came out of that Bill Tritt invention of that mistake. That was Robert heard about this, went over and looked at it. We all went over there. We had Abner Doble in this automobile company to create for us his original Doble steam engine over again with a modern I found him back here in Milwaukee working for the Cleaver Brooks company that was a client of ours in the boiler air fire boiler
right.
And this fellow unfortunately was an alcoholic. He was already 68 or something like that, well along the years, but we hauled him all the way to California and the wife would try to keep him in the hotel and he'd come over and we'd work with him for a whole day or two and then he'd disappear for 3 or 4 days and you couldn't find him anymore. And we'd have to go on what he'd given us to last a week or two or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how Robert got into the idea of building a sports car, mm-hmm. of like about the size of a Mercury convertible, only a hardtop convertible now. That's a two-way car. I mean, you have it open
right.
or closed.
Yes.
And before any of these things like you developed with the automatic roof
right,
coming
yeah.
and five different things folded and it went into the rear, which I had done for the Paris show in 53. And the Ford people were on the stand when I had the car called the Gaylord there, which is right there.
I want to hear about that.
See that
yes.
second one there?
Yes.
And that was built for the hairpin people down in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And it absorbed the top inside of the trunk. I had the trunk electronically
right.
open.
Uh-huh.
The top swung back and down in there and it closed over.
They copied
and
it?
They, well, that's where they got
the clamshell.
I stood there on the stand and heard them. I'm trying to think of Donald, whoever was head of engineering at the time, I can't think who the hell it was, but they came on the stand and they're saying, geez, you know, you guys said this couldn't be done, here it is. And so, well, they said, but Christ, that's a two-seater. You know, that's a short top, that's no problem, blah, blah, blah. and that's been played with, but anything to get out of the mess.
Yeah.
But they went back home and did the one where you cut the roof, you know, and
right.
folded it and then mm-hmm. brought it down inside there because it was too long.
But very cumbersome.
In fact, David had one of those first cars. I had the pictures of that here somewhere to show you, but he had the actual first one of those things as his own personal car, but it was a very expensive job, and I guess you built it for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
It's 65 or something like that. Seven. So
there's a gentleman at Ford named Gil Spear Jr. who
was the one that did
probably developed it from here. Mm-hmm. There was an earlier model though, a French Citroën.
Renault or somebody.
Renault had them years
yes,
before.
They
yes.
said, showed a
right.
thing. They built some of those that
yeah.
revolved the top,
right.
but all done by hand.
Right, yeah.
You lifted up
but yours
the deck
was automatic. Yeah.
Automatic,
yeah.
yeah. That was the first one.
Mm. And that was on the...
On the Gaylord and...
Let's get to the Gaylord in a moment, but tell us what happened to the Paxton.
Oh, okay. So we built six prototypes, and this is where we built the bodies in fiberglass.
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted it done as a production vehicle mm-hmm. with separate fenders and door panels and hood and deck and quarter panels and so forth,
mm-hmm.
instead of just a big, the first Bill Tritt sports cars were just like an XK120, this
right.
thing here,
mm-hmm.
where they'd mold this thing and then take it off the mold as one piece shell and saw the doors out and then put them back in with hinges so that you didn't have to climb over the side. In fact, the very first ones you climbed over the side, like the early Excalibur.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that really became the first attempt to do a production version of the convertible hardtop.
Mm-hmm.
And we got as far as building six prototypes, and they were going to have either the steam Doble plant in the rear or mm-hmm. a Junkers opposed piston two-cycle gasoline engine, which he was building, just a big version of the chainsaw concept engine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He was completely into aviation engines and two-cycle engines at that time.
Mr. McCullough.
McCullough.
Yeah.
And he spent a fortune on that. He
mm-hmm.
had, I mean, it was, he received on his 40th birthday, which would have been like in 1951 or something, 50 or something.
Mm-hmm.
$40 million from the John I. Beggs Traction Company fortune out of St. Louis, where his mother had been a Beggs.
Mm.
And we had Beggs Isle here in the lake out here in Wisconsin where they had a summer home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this money came from.
Nice.
I went traveled back on the super cheap with him with a suitcase full of securities.
Oh.
And we went down into Wall Street and turned that into cash so that he could then do with it what he wanted. And that's when he built the big plant out there and really fancy home and
mm-hmm.
Palm Springs. And
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. He was a great entrepreneur.
But the Paxton never got off the ground.
It was decided that to try to mass produce it, it was just way beyond it.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the industry had come alive then after the war, and
yes.
it was just couldn't
yeah.
compete. We were shooting at $2,985 or something
mm-hmm.
like that
right.
for 2,500 cars. What the hell? It finally wasn't a business. But we had a little plant set up. We built a plant for it, a model plant.
Where was that?
Right across, next to the we designed his whole office building and manufacturing plant at Mines Field, which was now the Los Angeles Airport.
Oh, really?
Right across the street. It's still there today.
Oh, good.
And this was next door to it, a separate
uh-huh.
called Paxton Engineering.
What was the name of the field?
Mines Field. That was what was called, that was the wartime name of the Los Angeles Airport, which became the airport of today. So then...
What has happened to those prototypes? Have they survived?
No, they did up until a few years ago, and finally, when after Robert was gone, Barbara and the sons decided to dispose of them, and they sold them. I was offered one of the cars, but it was so goddamn expensive, I just couldn't. Mm-hmm. For the museum, it would have been a great thing if it could have been, but we would have had to pay. They were bidding on these. They were auctioning. Yes. People just bid them up to, I mean, up then.
Yes,
now
right.
It would have to be 200,000 or something, but it was plenty then.
Uh-huh.
And a little too much for just to put one there to say you designed it, mm-hmm. although there are a lot there that say that.
Yes.
So then I guess probably we moved from there to Studebaker Corporation, which was when...
Had the Gaylord come in between?
Yeah, that was for the Paris show in 54 or like that.
We'll get to that, yes.
And, well, that's about that time.
What was the Gaylord concept? What was that?
Well, that's this hardtop convertible.
Yes.
Oh, which was a tubular frame.
Of course, yes.
Big Cadillac engine moved back in the frame and mm-hmm. a special body on it. That was an all-metal job. I built it at Spohn in Germany. Mm-hmm. I used